We're live on YouTube, so if you want to join us on the Q&A, go to our YouTube channel. We're live here. All right, let's do this. Let's jump into it. First question is, how much curcumin do you recommend daily to hopefully help with thinning hair? What's your thoughts on this?
I love curcumin. And also, too, I say it 1,000 different ways. So if sometimes I'll say curcumin, I think is the hardest word to say. It's a natural occurring anti-inflammatory. And I use it, honestly, I don't use it a ton for thinning hair. I use it more for like joint pain, inflammation. You'll see high sensitivity C-reactive protein elevated on a Cleveland or a lab. Curcumin is a really, really potent anti-inflammatory. You can take an absorptive amount of curcumin. I had a patient one time, this is when I first started, this is like 4 or 5 years ago, starting as a provider. He had really bad tinnitus or tinnitus. So that's another one that you can flip up those. So ringing in the ear, crazy amounts of it. And he took so much curcumin that he turned yellow. I think he was taking 4 grams a day, something insane. And I could have that number wrong, but he was taking a lot and it got rid of the ringing in his ear, but he turned yellow. It did. Really? It totally got rid of it, but it was, it can actually color your skin just like vitamin A can do that too. Vitamin A can turn your skin orange or a reddish color. So curcumin, I would say take around 1,000. Each one, usually in the pills from Life Extension, they're about 400 milligrams, but I think taking at least 800, if not up to like 1,000, 1,200, consider even 2,000 milligrams. I think that too, the more anti-inflammation you see from that, probably the better it's going to be for hair too. There's a lot of other stuff that you can do for hair naturally. Biotin, collagen, even to finding out what the root cause of thinning hair can be, ruling out thyroid dysfunction, hormone dysfunction. Women need estrogen and progesterone for good hair, skin, and nails. So as you age into postmenopause, making sure that that's on there is good. We have like a Dr. Rogers vitamin for healthy hair that I looked at today. It's got some stuff in there that I haven't used before. I don't even know if I have that in front of me of what our formula is for, but it's good. Usually go-tos are biotin, collagen. Curcumin is not going to hurt at all. Technically thinning hair, you think of blocking DHT, just throwing that out there. Blocking DHT primarily with men, testosterone to dihydrotestosterone is going to be causes of thinning hair. And you can block that in a lot of natural ways too. Saw palmetto, singing nettle. I think there's one sort of root, usually proprietary blends to help out with that.
Super interesting. So you're saying with thinning hair, the main focus for you is blocking the DHT.
And that's for me personally, yes, because testosterone can convert to dihydrotestosterone, which can cause thinning hair. I think it's important to know what's the cause of thinning hair and then try to work on that etiology first, then add the naturals with it. Sometimes too, we're having a lot of people that are losing a lot of weight and also losing some of their hair too. With extreme weight loss, you can get thinning hair. I kind of like beating it to the punch before it happens, especially too, because it's so much harder to grow hair than it is to keep hair. So you want to keep it. So if you start to notice it losing, start those naturals. Curcumin's great. Again, like try to hit like 1,000 milligrams or a little bit higher. And I believe it's safe up to 4 grams. I'll double check that. But biotin, collagen, honestly, like a prenatal vitamin has really good stuff in it too.
And I'll just to put this, because it's related to this question. I first get my pellets, hair starts coming out. So that is kind of what you're alluding to, Ange. So thank you, Barbara.
Depends on that. Yeah. And that's something too, that might be in the pellet. It might be that initial influx of testosterone is most likely the cause of that, with a little bit, because when testosterone comes in, it has to do something. So it's either going to do everything you want T to do and hit all those receptors, or it's going to convert into something. So it can convert into estradiol. It can convert into dihydrotestosterone. And that's usually what that looks like. But two, even with females, I never discount thyroid, especially too, if you're on pellets for hormone dysfunction, thyroid can absolutely be part of that, and your numbers can look perfect. So I wouldn't discount thyroid too, to take a look into that, depending on what type of pellet you're getting.
All right. I love that question. Thank you for sending that in over email. I'm going to put this up as our second question because we got to hang out this weekend, and you mentioned to me that you're actually trying to cut back on caffeine. So is that like a health thing? Are you thinking, you know, less caffeine better? The question here is caffeine free, yes or no? If so, what are some alternatives to tea and coffee? What do you think here?
Man, that's good because, okay, Ben and I, we went to brunch on Sunday. And my decaf coffee was after my like third or fourth cup of regular coffee. Like, so it wasn't like I was going caffeine free. That doesn't make it sound really like noble for me, but that was not, yeah. So I'm not going caffeine free, but
you were cutting back.
I was cutting back. I do think there's actually a healthy balance. That's a really great question. Caffeine actually has a ton of benefits. It's one of those things in life where a little can go a long way and a lot can go the wrong way. Does that make sense? It's like, it's meant to be there. It's even with how I'm going to get off on a tangent. I promise I'll come back to caffeine free. My answer is probably not. I would say depends on what your medical history looks like. And I would say, no, I would not be caffeine free. I would have some sort of caffeine. I like the tea and coffee. What comes with tea and coffee, the bad stuff is usually going to be what you add to it. So if you have sweet tea, or if you have, you know, a pumpkin spice latte every day, you're getting all the other stuff in with the actual coffee bean, tea leaf that naturally has caffeine in it. So usually it's the additives that I don't like to tea and coffee, or don't prefer to it. Though, you know, when PSLs come out, I'm in. I love me some pumpkin spice. There's some good alternatives. Lucas actually has like a natural pumpkin spice, or like a less bad for you pumpkin spice. But I think caffeine works against something called adenosine. This is going to get kind of like nerdy, but like adenosine works in the body more for rest and digest. Caffeine is more fight or flight stimulant. It also works like kind of as an anti-inflammatory. A lot of migraine medicines have caffeine in it because it decreases and vasoconstricts when there's dilation and inflammation. Caffeine is also in naturally in coffee, and coffee is really, really good for your liver. It's actually really good for neurodegenerative health. Caffeine, like I was looking up stuff about caffeine when you sent me this question. There's a ton of benefits to caffeine. I believe like there's this one case of a caffeine overdose, and it was some sort of crazy, crazy number of how much caffeine he was taking. There's important things to note with this question too. Tea and coffee are usually served warm, and that's going to slow the digestion of the caffeine. So when you have something chilled, it like speeds it up, and caffeine's pretty quick. Caffeine's pretty quick with absorption too. It peaks really quick. It's like 99% of it is absorbed in 45 minutes. So it's quick in, quick out. I like it. I just think that if you do too much, that's when you're going to get palpitations, tremors, increased blood pressure and heart rate. You can get a nervousness and anxiety from it. Recommended is usually between 50 milligrams to 300 milligrams a day. And an average cup of coffee that you make at home is around 95 milligrams of caffeine. So there's some studies saying that 3 to 5 cups of coffee a day is actually really, really good for like your overall health. I would say until you actually get, caffeine can be a diuretic too. So it can make you lose a little bit of water, but you also, part of your fluid intake for the day can be counted from the coffee that you drink. Anything that's found naturally, I think is a good thing, or can be, have a potential to be a good thing. So I'd say for the question for this is, I would watch your intake and watch your response to baseline symptoms. Do you get nervous when you drink caffeine? Does it make you feel alert? Does it help you complete tasks? Does it brighten up your brain? It has a lot of benefits. I'd say don't overdo it. And if you don't like it because you drink one cup of coffee and you immediately start shaking or feel like you're heart beating, then it's probably not for you. Alternatives to tea and coffee, You can do decaffeinated tea and coffee. They take most of it out. I think somewhere around 10% or less still kind of lives in there. There's also something called mud. Have you ever heard of mud?
I feel like that's come up on the show.
I feel like once or twice. Mud alternative to coffee. Yes. Yeah. It's called mud. It's a coffee alternative. It's like, it has like mushrooms in it. I'm pretty sure it still has caffeine in it. And matcha, so much of that still has it. I'd probably say if you're looking for alternatives because you want to be totally off of caffeine, is looking at the adaptogens like saffron, L-theanine, ashwagandha, something that's going to be more cortisol balancers instead of cortisol stimulators. That's what I'd say if you're looking for alternatives.
And one other thing, I know
like wine.
I know people are just kidding. Drinking methylene blue as a way to like focus and have some energy. I don't know if it has caffeine in it though. Would that be an alternative?
Yeah, methylene blue is really good for oxygenation. That's why I always think of methylene blue, because if you're thinking of carbon monoxide poisoning, methylene blue is a treatment to help oxygenize the cell. So I think oxygen, and two, your brain lives on that stuff. Your brain lives on glucose and it lives off oxygen. So you're going to feel more cognitive function, be more alert with that stuff.
And I'm seeing here from Margot, RPA in the Fountain City office, 4 sigmatic mushroom coffee mix with lion's mane has about half the caffeine, 50 milligrams. So this is kind of another brand of mud. Super cool.
That's great too. And you can kind of get those same benefits. I do feel like so much of like coffee in the morning is habit. Most people wake up and that's what they crave because that's more routine, not I need caffeine.
All right, we're going to keep moving here, Ange. Let's go to an omega-3 question. Omega-3 is kind of top of mind. We talked with a couple cardiologists on tomorrow's Common Sense MD. They touch on omega-3s a little bit. There's some controversy. Which omega-3 do you like? I think it's orthomolecular, but they have a few different ones. What's your thoughts on this?
Orthomolecular is awesome. That's a good brand of vitamins. Same way with the Life Extension one, but I know what you're saying, like the caramel color. Sometimes there can be, like sometimes you'll look at some of the stuff on Life Extension of what they add, which I don't know why, maybe preservatives, maybe to encapsulate it. I think the big thing to think about with omega-3s is sourcing and how soon you use them. Because oil, it's an oil, and oils sitting around forever can become rancid, and you don't want to put it in heat. You don't want to freeze it. Like there's a lot of stuff you just want to really keep that even, use it more quickly, and get it from a source. You want a small fish versus a larger fish. There's a little bit increased risk for mercury if you go from the sourcing to a larger fish. There's one particular one that I used for a little bit and really liked, and I can't remember the brand, but we have one. We have one now, and that's the one that I'm switching to. Omega-3s, so these are polyunsaturated fats. The thing and the benefit about omega-3 is that it can be anti-inflammatory. It can be really great for cardiovascular disease, great for the heart, really good for the brain if you're able to absorb it well. So the brain, this is our omega-3 mix. This is let me look at this real quick. It's a monoglyceride delivery system. Reading into that too is really, really great. The monoglyceride delivery system enhances absorption of lipid-based and lipid-soluble nutraceutical and food ingredients. So that monoglyceride, that's what's going to make a difference for how well you absorb it. And two, what you're trying to absorb is the particular breakdown of omega-3 called EPA and DHA. So EPA and DHA are pretty crucial to brain and cognitive function. So that's one thing that's why people do omegas. Omegas are non-essential fatty acids. You have to get them from the environment. And so sourcing, I do think, matters. I think orthomolecular is great. I think too, you should give ours a try too. And the best way to test vitamins, I've said this several times, is to test your blood. doing a whole omega-3 check and see if you're actually absorbing some of those. You should see those numbers be elevated. And choose one with EPA and DHA.
And we'll keep we'll put up the Dr. Rogers Omega Max up more if you guys want. We're gonna
and keep moving. There's natural ones. Like, you can get those from the environment too. You don't have to choose a supplement. So you can choose foods and oils that are just naturally higher in omega-3s.
All right, Chuck, I see your question. Lisa, what's up? Coal miner's daughter's in the building. Okay, I see Maha's question, One Step Forward's question. Katie, what's going on? We're going to get to one more question here, and then we're going to get to live questions. So if you have a question for Andy, go ahead and put it in the comments. We're going to get to those shortly. And here we go. This is kind of right in your wheelhouse. Best way to treat insulin resistance and lose weight when nothing works. I'm sure you hear this all the time, so I'm going to let you kind of take it away.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, that I feel like, did you know I was coming on? I love talking about this stuff. This is exciting. So insulin resistance, I think it's important to know what that is. Insulin is a hormone that everybody has except me and like a few other people. So insulin is a hormone that regulates where glucose goes, but also stores fat. In its definition, it says inhibits lipolysis, so preventing the breakdown of fat, so that you store it for winter when we went through hibernation periods. It's an evolutionary biological hack. Now, a lot of people in the modern world are resistant to insulin because a lot of it is genetic, because we inherit these genotypes that are we become more prone to insulin resistance. We also live in a world that doesn't promote the proper function of insulin. We don't really incorporate periods of fasting as much, which is why intermittent fasting helps out with insulin resistance. And we're not nearly as active as we once were. We're active here, but not somatically in our bodies. So best way to treat insulin resistance, I think, is to start with nutrition and exercise. You have to do those things. It sounds like when nothing else works, I'm assuming maybe that you've tried those things. Looking at anything that's going to be nutrition is decreasing the stimulation of insulin. Insulin is going to be pretty much 90 to 100% responsive to carbohydrates, much less responsive for proteins, and nearly negligible response for fats, which is why ketogenic diets, mainly fats and proteins and fat breakdown, which is where keto comes from, that's why those work for insulin resistance most of the time. Exercise also stimulates glucose to get into the cell of the muscle so that insulin doesn't have to work as hard for that. I think the GLP-1s and GIP class, these novel classes, the Mounjaros, the Ozempics, the Rybelsus, those drugs work so well because they work within the incretin system, which sensitizes insulin. I think that's probably the best way, especially too when we live. I just got back from England. I've told nearly every patient this. Like, England's different. Europe's different. Their food's different. My blood sugars were never better. My skin was never better until Margot gets me one of these water systems in my house. their food's different. My blood sugars were never over 150, and I ate fish and chips 3 times a day. Like, something's different in what they're doing over there. So I think so much of what we're experiencing is our sourcing of food here. I've had a lot of patients who have moved from other countries who say the same thing. And so that's why I think these drugs work or should be, we should be able to get more affordably, compounds, retail, whatever. Because I think they work so well for us living in America, honestly. I know that sounds like very conspiracy theorist, but that's just what I've seen and personally experience. Answer to this is GLP, GIP class is, I think, the best when nothing else works. Even into noting, documenting what insulin resistance looks like. You can test your baseline insulin and see peptide, which is the breakdown or cleaving off byproduct of inactive insulin to active insulin, noticing how active your insulin is, what the response to no food and food looks like too, to see if there's insulin resistance.
Great question. Great topic. You guys, if you're with us live, you can tell Andy deals with this every single day. Great answer there, Ange. I love that. Any diabetes questions in the live comments, now's a great week to do it. We're going to get to the live questions here, guys. I see here, Barbara, we're definitely going to get to that pellet question. I'm sorry, I didn't get that to begin with. We'll get that here in a second, but we're going to go ahead in here and get things going. If you have a question for Andy, go ahead and put it in the comments. Let's start with Roel. Roel, thanks for coming on a Monday for us. Hello, Andy and Ben. I have a nephew who is 21 and is having major issues with his stomach. His dad has a family history of diverticulitis. Can he maybe use BPC-157 for healing? BPC-157 is a peptide we've talked quite a bit about. Ange, what's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, for sure. I think he absolutely can. It might be worth it to kind of dig deeper into what his stomach issues are. With diverticulitis, that is inflammation of diverticulosis, which are little pockets found really in the sigmoid colon. So it's the lower left quadrant of your belly that have pretty severe symptoms. And those little pockets can become pockets of infection. So there's different treatment modalities that if your nephew's developed a little bit of early onset diverticulosis, which can then turn to diverticulitis, BPC-157 is great for the healing of the gut lining because that's where that peptide's derived from. So it's with gut healing for sure, but it doesn't necessarily not make you have pockets, if that makes sense. So I would say I would dive a little bit further into him with what the major stomach issues are too. Too, being 21 years old, sometimes you want to look into almost like serotonin. Serotonin, 85% of it's in your gut. And you can have a lot of gut issues if there's any sort of anxiety, stress that he deals with as well. You can have crazy stomach issues with that. I'd say BPC-157 is not going to hurt anything. It's only going to help, but it may not get to the root if you don't do a little further investigation. That would be my suggestion, is further investigate, have a provider ask a ton of questions about gut health to see if he needs any imaging, and then start BPC-157.
Roel,
thanks for that. And you want to take it orally, yeah. By the way. There's oral and there's subcutaneous. You want to take that orally.
Great question there, Roel. Thank you for putting that in there.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm going to put this up just so Andy can see it. Stephanie's.
Oh,
I love that.
Oh, yes. Stephanie in the house. Yes. Oh, my God.
All right. Let's get to Barbara's question here. So we put this up with the hair loss question. I first get my pellets and my hair starts coming out. She's asking, what does she do now? Like, what is something? You mentioned a few things. Let's kind of talk about this in the context of hormone pellets and how you would look at that.
So two, I would test my levels. I would start to see where your testosterone peaks too, if testosterone is included in your pellets. And also too, see if you're a converter. See if you convert to dihydrotestosterone. There's several ways. Usually when females get symptomatic with androgen type symptoms or higher testosterone symptoms, you're going to probably start with something like spironolactone that kind of flushes out the androgenic side effects when introducing testosterone. Because hopefully you feel good with your pellets. Anytime you're looking at pellets, you want to look at risk benefit of, does it relieve my baseline symptoms? And are the side effects manageable or non-existent? And if they're manageable, then it's almost like you nip things in the butt before it happens. So I would say my suggestion would be to get your labs to see, are you a converter to dihydrotestosterone? How high is your testosterone peaking? Look or request it looking something like spironolactone, usually 50 milligrams 1 to 2 times daily. You can go up to 100 milligrams twice daily easily with no potassium. And then any of the naturals are going to be good. Any of the naturals. Biotin, collagen, but for you, if it's really specific to every time I get my pellet, my hair starts coming out, it's probably that introduction of testosterone. And I think spironolactone would probably be the best thing for you. You could do a little finasteride. Finasteride's technically the DHT blocker. You could do a little bit of that as well. You'd want to keep the dose really, really low.
Barbara, I hope that helps. Ange, thank you for that.
It's a great question.
Yeah, it's a really, really good
question. I hate that's happening. That's no fun. I hope you feel good with the pellet, though. I hope it's like, I feel great, and this is also coming out. It's like, that's a good place to be. Not, I feel terrible, and also my hair is coming out. It's like, we got to play music with your pellet, okay? We got to play that Casey Musgrave, that Dolly.
Tracy is wanting you to work some magic here. Andy, can you work your magic and make my head cold gone like yesterday? I have misplaced Dr. Roger's vitamin protocol. So what we might want to do here, Andy, is go over the protocol and hopefully this helps Tracy. And Tracy, we hope you feel better yesterday, like now.
Oh, you poor thing. Yeah. I'm sorry. That sucks. I know. To get it really gone yesterday, start taking a Z-Pack. I hate to say it. That's such a cheap answer, but that's going to be the quickest. Is a Z-Pack. Zithromycin usually works as an antibacterial. We learned a lot during COVID that there might be some antiviral properties to it and some anti-inflammatory properties. So you're going to feel better yesterday if you take a Z-Pack. But if you're looking for Dr. Rogers' vitamin protocol, really amping up vitamin D3 to 50,000 IUs, vitamin C with quercetin to 2,000 milligrams. You can do 2,000 milligrams twice a day, but really 1,000 twice a day works well. Doing zinc 50 milligrams, you can do that 1 to 2 times daily. Quercetin's in there. What else was in there? Those are the big three. B12, I know, is in there. B-complex omegas.
That's what I would think. I would think that protocol with DC and zinc.
Those are the big three.
Yeah. We also let me see if I have this in here. We have the immune complex that's kind of like a supercharged protocol. I don't have a graphic for that, Tracy. But what Ange just said is definitely the protocol that Doc talks about all the time. Okay, let's keep going. Tracy, we hope you feel better now. We hope you feel better now. Let's see here. I'm on One Step Forward over on YouTube. I've been doing a ketovore diet, less than 10 grams of carbs, doing intermittent fasting since January for gut and energy issues with great results. Also lost 40 pounds continued. Let me see if I can find it.
Wow.
That's incredible. I would like to gain muscle mass and gain weight. Working out with weights 4 days a week and very active on job. Any advice? Awesome show. One Step Forward.
First off, that's awesome. That's freaking awesome. So it seems like you're doing everything nutritionally. It seems like you're doing everything nutritionally. You're also doing everything through exercise as well. Protein, like really ramping up protein and getting it very bioavailable. The perfect aminos, that's one of the more bioavailable proteins. And we're all probably underserved in the amount of protein that we get. And protein is going to support muscle growth. I don't know the particular recommendations on how much protein. That might be a Lucas question, but it's an insane amount. We don't really get enough. It's just my personal opinion. We don't get enough from nutrition or can get enough. So I think getting something that's going to help you absorb it more efficiently within your gut is going to be beneficial for you, especially if you're wanting to really gain muscle mass. Another thing is to look at the peptides. Growth hormone is amazing. And if you took Anavar, you'd have insane muscle. Everybody would look like Arnold Schwarzenegger with Anavar. We just don't prescribe it here in the US. So getting a growth hormone stimulant without giving growth hormones, probably going to be your best bet. So looking at Somorlin, CJC, IPAM, those are going to be the ones I think you would do phenomenal with. I think Dad gained a lot of weight back on CJC, IPAM.
Yep.
He did. I think he gained like nearly 25 pounds back when he had that big gut issue.
And I'll put this up here. Robin Riddle did and explained this on CJC 1295 with Ipamorlin, which is what Andy's talking about with CJ IPAM. And I think Dad's on it right now, isn't he? Is he still doing it?
Yeah, I think so. I'm doing it too. I love it.
Are you?
I'm hiding all my muscle. I'm wearing black. It's very thinning right now, but that's a great question though. Great question.
One Step Forward. Thank you so much. I want to get to Maha on LinkedIn. Thank you so much for following us over there. What would you recommend for individuals with hyperthyroidism? And what is your take on low dose naltrexone? I love this question for you. This is something I know you deal with every day.
Oh man, that's a great one. And if you're going through this, I'm sorry, because hyperthyroidism is much less common than hypothyroidism and much harder to treat. So you're having overactive thyroid instead of underactive thyroid. Usually when you put these up on paper, you're looking at low thyroid, meaning low metabolism, weight gain, low energy, I'm really cold, my blood pressure's low, extreme fatigue. Hyperthyroidism, you're really looking at a lot of like, almost like a stressed, anxious look, like excessive sweating and hot tempered, inability to sleep, palpitations, tremors. It's very shaky. And that's a very tough diagnosis. So I hate you're going through that if that's something you're experiencing or a family member or a close one. But honestly, I think that's a great referral for endocrinology because they've got a better tap on it. Personally, what I like using is propranolol. Propranolol is a beta blocker. It helps out with the somatic symptoms that come from hyperthyroid thyroidism. And so I think propranolol is great because you'll get symptomatic relief. It's a very benign beta blocker, old school cardiovascular drug. And it has like 10,000 benefits to it. Propranolol, 10 to 40 milligrams, 1 to 2 times daily. And then hyperthyroidism too, looking at methimazole. It's methimazole and PTU. Methimazole or tapazole, 5 milligrams to start with. You can do it twice daily, 3 times daily, but that will start to help tamper down those numbers. Low-dose naltrexone is amazing too because LDN is going to help decrease the anti-inflammatory side effects of really any autoimmune. If it's Graves' hyperthyroidism, then you're looking at autoimmunity. So I think LDN's not going to hurt anything. I don't really see LDN being a negative for anyone unless you're on opiates, because it will negatively affect how you're absorbing that. So I think for you, or for this question, propranolol, methimazole, looking into these, because we're not, these are all just like recommendations, opinions, because we're not treating people on air, but propranolol, methimazole, and LDN, I think are great combos. And I think if you're looking at least to most invasive, you're looking at propranolol, then LDN, then something like methimazole, and tracking numbers with that too.
Maha, thank you so much for putting
that. That's a great question. That's a really great question. It's a great question.
It's interesting. We don't talk enough about hyperthyroidism. So so thank you for that answer, Ange. Maha, I hope that helps. Let's keep moving here. Where am I at? I'm going to put this up from Chuck on Facebook. When intermittent fasting, which vitamins can I take first thing in the morning on an empty stomach? Chuck is one of my Knoxville people. Hope you
get okay. Knox was in the house.
Knox is in the house. So what's your thoughts on this?
Oof. Personally, I don't like any vitamins on an empty stomach. That's just me. So two, anything you're going to look at vitamins that are best absorbed, you have to look at how they're absorbed. If they're water-soluble vitamins, like B vitamins, you can take them on an empty stomach because it just needs water to absorb. It's water-soluble. If you're looking at vitamins like A, C, D, E, it's called aqueducts. So A, C, E, and D, those are, and K, I think, is in there too. Those are fat solubles. Those need fats in there to actually digest and absorb them most efficiently. So I think too, I wouldn't do anything on an empty stomach. I've done that before, especially zinc, and I throw up every time. So I'd almost say it's probably better for you if you take it when you break your fast, unless you're doing something just for energy right in the morning. But personally, I take all my vitamins at night, and I'm absorbing them because I test them on labs. So I take nearly every vitamin as I go to bed because I know I'm going to take low-dose naltrexone. I won't miss that, so I don't miss the others. But I would just watch for, if you did any of them, do the water-soluble ones, and zinc's the one that if you don't really take with food, it's going to make you nauseous.
Chuck, thank you for that. It's a very common question, especially when, you know, we talk as much about vitamins as we do. It can get kind of confusing as to when to take each one. I know the thing you talk about, Andy, all the time is just getting in a routine, getting in a ritual of taking them.
Yeah.
Chuck, I hope that helps. Let's get to, I want to get this up here because I'm so proud of my grandmother.
Oh, Kiki. For you, Kiki.
Look at this. This is both of our grandmothers, Grandma Mary. She's over on YouTube. I'm in my 80s, exercise daily. However, I like my English afternoon tea and a glass of red wine in the evening. What's your thoughts of this combo?
Kiki, I think you are living your best life. If I end up anything like you, I will have made it. You are what we call you. And there's a few other people I've told this to. You especially are what we call hashtag goals. You are hashtag goals. And so you're killing it. Drink that red wine. You better be having English afternoon tea with me so that we can discuss England. I think both of those, this is in all honesty, I think both of those are really fine. There's health benefits. There are some health benefits you can argue with a glass of red wine too. It's got some resveratrol in it. What I like really about red wine is when you're in community with people, it gets you out and with people. So that's what I think the best part about red wine is. And two, afternoon tea in England, you're sharing afternoon tea with people. So it's a time to sit and take a break from what you're doing and talk to somebody. I think those are the actual health benefits from both of those. I think those are, if you do too much of it, you would be noticing symptoms. Afternoon tea, if you're starting to have heart troubles where you start to have it beat a little bit too fast, or the glass of red wine, if it's making you so drowsy that you end up having a fall, that's what you don't want with either of those extremes. But I don't, with the way you're doing it, I think it's perfect, but I also think you're perfect, Kiki.
Grandma Mary, you are perfect. Thank you so
you
much
are.
For being
She's
with
our
us.
Mary Poppins. She's practically perfect. Just practically
She's perfect.
Perfect.
She is perfect. All right, let's get to Cindy here on Facebook. I take a melatonin gummy and a Dr. Rogers CBD gummy before bed. Is that breaking my fast? Good question.
God, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. This is going to be kind of a piecemeal answer. I think technically, yes. Technically, yes. A true fast is nothing on your belly except water. So does it technically break the fast? Yes. Does it really? It's probably negligible. It's probably what we call a dirty fast. So dirty fasts are when you ingest something that's not going to have a ton of insulin stimulation or release. And so with both of those products, I do know both of those. I think there is some dextrose in those. So you'll probably have minimal insulin response, but that technically does break your fast. Which CBD gummy? I've had those. Those are gnarly.
Yep. Yep.
The red
they
one.
Are.
Have you had the red ones?
No.
Oof. Oof. Oh yeah. But so I don't think it's going to be harmful enough to your fast that it's, I think that would be considered a dirty fast, but the answer technically is yes.
Yeah. I was going to make sure you touched on the insulin there, if it does affect it. But what you're saying is that it is negligible technically.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's negligible, but the technical answer is yes, but negligible in the long run.
Cindy, thank you so much. Welcome in.
Yes, thank you.
People come in. Welcome to the Performance Medicine Show.
Welcome to the family. Welcome to the Performance Medicine. I'm just kidding. I'm trying to make you laugh. Let's just say the same thing at the same time.
Welcome to the Performance Medicine Show.
If
you have a question for Andy,
just kidding, you're better at this than I am. You go.
If you got a question for Andy, go ahead and put it in the comments. We're getting to every single question tonight. Yes. And this includes Amy's question. What do you think about berberine? My back doctor told me about it.
Love it. Love it. Go ham on it. Well, they'll go ham on it. Berberine, I really call the natural metformin. It's derived kind of from that same ancient Chinese barberry bush or shrub. Berberine works antagonistically or against the liver with glucagon production and positively for insulin secretion. So you're getting decreased glucagon, so not as much sugar into the bloodstream, and you're getting sensitized insulin from the pancreas. It's a no-brainer. I think berberine's amazing. Usually dosed as a 400 milligram over-the-counter tablet, and you can take up to 4 times a day or with every meal. I think that's a no-brainer, yes.
And I know I've asked Doc this, but you can take berberine when you're on a GLP-1 too, right?
You can. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. But might not.
You can. Okay. Or two, you might not need as much, but two, those are going to work synergistically with each other. It depends on what you're using it for. If you're using it for more weight balance, metabolic syndrome, then you're not going to see much change with what your insulin does. But if you're using it for type 2 diabetes, where you're having true insulin dysregulation, glucose dysregulation, then you probably need to be cognizant of the doses that you do and do it slowly. Mm.
Amy, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for that question. We got Stephanie in the building tonight in our Fountain City location.
What? Stop. Stephanie in his house. Stephanie, Fountain City. What?
All right, we got Katie. Look, Katie's saying we look great tonight.
Katie's on the house. What?
Katie's in the house.
Listen, if I could be half as tan as you, then this light wouldn't pick me up right now, okay? If I could be half as tan, as beautiful as you and Carter, good God. Whew, I cannot tell you how many people come in. Now, those twins, they're beautiful, right? I was like, I know, they are. They're just the best.
So, I love it. Katie and Carter, we love you so much. Thank you for being with us. And thank you for everything that you guys do. Yeah. All right, let's keep moving here. Let's get to Kathy here. Kathy, thank you for hanging out. Hey, Andy.
Kathy. Kathy. I love me some Kathy. I love me.
We love us some Kathy.
I do.
So the question is, at what age can I bring my teenager in to get a Cleveland? This is a great question because how young can you get a Cleveland heart panel?
Now, I don't know about coverage might be different to, so coverage is, as far as about an insurance, my personal opinion is to be, what are we looking for on the Cleveland? So that's something I ask every patient when they come in. It's like, what were you drawing this? What prompted it? Do you feel bad? Or are you just checking to see what things look like because you feel amazing? And I have patients that do both. I think really the big thing out of a Cleveland is the hormone panel that you get with it. So if you're looking at a younger teenager, you might have some testosterone. You might have some thyroid dysfunction early that you might catch and find. But when you're looking at hormones, it depends on what Tanner stages they're in and if they've gone through puberty. So it would probably be in the best benefit to probably wait till you're 18. That would be my first guess. You can probably get it a little younger. We may have had some that have done it at like 16.
What I'm getting from Kathy here is it's for blood pressure.
Blood pressure. Okay. Yeah. Man, blood pressure could be from a number of things too. You might find some inflammatory markers. You might find some metabolic dysfunction or insulin resistance that might be on it. The genotypes of like an MTHFR might be a little bit helpful. With high blood pressure in kids too, God, that's a good question. I actually don't have a great answer for that too. Peds is not really my specialty. It definitely depends on the age, like the actual age and where they are through puberty. I think that's important. And two, with blood pressure, I'd probably tailor that. I would definitely, if you draw it, talk to someone before so you can tailor that lab to have more specificity with it. Because sometimes when you have these secondary causes of hypertension where you don't know, most of hypertension is essential. It just happens. I think like 90 to 95% of hypertension just happens over time with atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries over time. But there's like 8 to 10 different causes of secondary etiologies of hypertension. And we had to learn them at one point for like boards, but like you'd want to specify that one to like look for renal dysfunction. Also looking at our lungs. With the RAS system and blood pressure, it's heart, kidneys, and lungs. So you're looking at all three of those to say, are they all three functioning properly? And as a result, am I getting hypertension? Most of what we'd see with hypertension is undertreated hypothyroidism. because two, the body compensates and clamps down on the arteries to help compensate for low blood pressure that comes from undertreated hypothyroidism. Does that make sense? The answer is, I probably let me know how old she is. We maybe talk at the office one day. I want to know how old she is, and two, probably get Dr. Rogers involved if we're going to do something that's more peds.
One question that I'm kind of having now after Kathy's wonderful question is, when do you kind of recommend a baseline Cleveland? Like, what
comments. 16 is close enough. 16 is close enough. I think you could do a Cleveland. I'd see what the pediatrician drew first and then see what wasn't drawn and have that on the Cleveland. I think that's a great thing. 16, okay. Yeah, she's not like 9. I didn't know if this was like a 9-year-old versus 16 is very different. You're adult weight, you're near adult age. I think that's fine.
All right, Kathy, I hope that
helps. What were you saying, Ben? You said the first time to draw a Cleveland?
Well, like, when is a good, because I know we have some young people in here. When do you recommend like a good baseline Cleveland? Because I know it's important to know where your hormones levels are at, before they start to decline. So we know where to get them to when they start to decline. What's kind of your recommendation?
I think when things start to, I always think about my face with collagen. You start to lose collagen around age 25 to 26. So I'd start around there and say two. And that's like, except for the Rogers, it's the median age for like getting married. Is that sad? I'm sorry. Did I say that out loud? I know. We're trying. We're trying, performance medicine family. We're trying. Okay. But like, most people are kind of going through marriage, starting to have kids. So you kind of want to get that baseline before that stuff happens, because all that stuff can put stressors on what your hormones look like. I think the real answer is, sorry, that got real for a second. We're trying, okay? But to doing it before you have the stressors in life, when you feel good, I think that's a good baseline.
All right. Thank you for that, Kathy. Thank you for teeing us up for that topic. This is another great topic from Camille. What are your thoughts on the popular semaglutide injection for weight loss? I know your answer, but Camille might not.
It's a no-brainer. It's one of the best things. Semaglutide, tirzepatide, these are GLP-1 and GLP-1 GIP receptor agonists, indicated for type 2 diabetes because it works on insulin resistance and insulin secretion. It also works positively against hunger hormones to diminish cravings. So I think semaglutide is a no-brainer. Yes. Depending on your history and depending on what you're looking for out of it. Yes. I think it's amazing.
Do you ever come across a scenario where the right thing to do is to get off semaglutide or Ozempic? Like, what's your, because I know there's two thoughts on this. Like, some people need to stay on it for a long time. Do you ever recommend somebody get off of it?
Two, if it's causing negative side effects. Yeah.
Okay.
Some people have lost too much weight on it.
Okay.
Or two, you start to lose a lot of muscle content. Or, hey, I've had it a couple of times where it's like, I love this drug. It's amazing. I never eat. I throw up all the time. That's not what you really want to lose weight with. You want to lose weight. You want to use these drugs because it makes you feel really good. And I'll have exactly the opposite where patients are like, I've never felt better. I've never felt more alive and energized. It's very nuanced and specific to the patient. So I think if it's causing anything with weight, you look at C's. I learned this from another practitioner over in Iowa. She's amazing. If it's not, weight should feel comfortable, confident, and not causing disease. If you're there with weight, you're at a good spot. And so too, I'd say continue it if it's providing you benefit. If it's causing you way too many side effects, if there's too much cost for the weight loss, then don't do it.
I love that answer.
That's a great question.
I'm going to put this up from Allison. Wanted to tell us that she started Methylene Blue last week. That's awesome. And it seems that, she answered all the questions on Jeopardy correctly. That's incredible. Methylene Blue.
Heck yeah. That's awesome. That is Methylene awesome.
Blue for the win. All right.
Yes.
Well, I think I've gotten to all the questions. We're almost to the hour mark, guys. If you have any last minute questions for Andy, go ahead and put them in. But for the time being, how do you guys think we did? 1 to 10. We like to kind of, you know, rate ourselves a little bit towards the end of the show.
Thanks, Roel. Okay, an 11. I was going to fix my hair before this. Hold on.
Roel is giving us an 11. And I don't know that we've ever gotten an 11. So
really?
That's high praise, Roel.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Thank you. I love coming on here and spending time with you all.
If you guys have any last minute questions, we're going to jump off here in just a second.
I have a last minute question.
What's that?
I have one. Have you read any of the books behind you in the bookshelf? Let's talk about Ben and his reading. Come on. Don't put that ruse up. How many books on that shelf have you read? And how many of them do not start with the title, The 4 Hour Something? Ben loves a good self-help book, y'all. Loves one.
I see I see lots of literature on that lit. They call that have you ever heard of To Kill a Mockingbird? It's up there.
No, the question has been, have you ever heard of that? Tell me one character name from To Kill a Mockingbird. Tell me one character.
Boo.
Name two. Come on. There's one other one that's really big.
Atticus.
Okay. You know what? I threw some shade over there because I thought you were going to start quoting Who Moved My Cheese.
Look at that. Matt is saying Scout. I didn't remember.
I was really looking for Scout. Thank you. We needed you.
I didn't remember.
Scott. Boo. Oh my God. Boo.
Well, I gotta put this up. Kathy's saying we got a 12. That's unreal. Carter saying
I've been through 10? Thick and thin though. We've been through thick and thin. We have my sweet Kathy. We have.
Chuck is saying we got a 10. Thank you, Chuck.
Yes.
Cindy's saying we got a 10. Roel for the last question is, are you ready for some football? I think Matt will join me on this. Matt will say it is almost football time in Tennessee. We are almost there.
God, I love it.
We're looking forward to a great season. So yes, Roel, we're pumped. You guys got Arch Manning down there in Texas. So I hope you guys got to have a great season as well. But man, we're getting some go big oranges here. Thank you guys. And how do you think we did? What would you give us if you were put on the spot, like 1 to 10, what would you give us? Be honest.
Ben, you're a hard 10, dude. You are what we call a dime piece. Okay. You're a stone cold stunner. You're a stone cold stunner. Look at that. You're a fox, dude. Give us a little shake of that hair.
I can't do what your hair does. Your hair is so flowy.
The Rogers have some curl, but I don't know where you got your hair, Ben. I don't know
it's straight. It's super straight. Grandma Mary's giving us an off the chart. Thank you.
Off the chart. Kiki, they don't make them like you anymore, Kiki. They don't. They just don't make them like you.
Guys, we are going to call it a show. I believe it's a show. Great. Do you want to call it a show? Was it a show?
That was a show.
Thanks, guys, for listening to this episode of the podcast. Please share the podcast with your friends. And if you haven't subscribed yet, please subscribe. We will see you guys next time.